Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Breakthrough Directions. Each week, Breakthrough Directions explores the two faces of your business, outward through marketing and client delivery, and inward, your vision, profit model, systems, team, and you, so you can grow a business you love and live the life of your dreams. Welcome to the show.
Well, welcome everyone to another episode of Breakthrough Directions here on Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, Gina Gaudio-Graves, the Dean and Founder of Directions University at directionsu.com, calling in this week live from Bonita Springs, Florida, as I do each week on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. We've got yet another wonderful show lined up for all of you. We have my co-host, Linda Feinholt, the founder of the Breakthrough Academy at breakthroughbydesign.com. Linda's calling in live from Los Angeles, California. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Gina. I am so delighted. I've really been looking forward to today's show because you and I spend a tremendous amount of time on the relationship marketing side of business, but relationships are what hold businesses together all together. And the guest that we have with us today really is focused on how you make a business work. The language has changed over time. Nowadays, it's called human resources and human resources management and organization management and so on. And Bob Snyderman is a master of all of it. And not only are we going to talk today about the relationship side of things, but guess what? We also get to talk about the legal side of things, because as soon as we start talking about human resources, it's all intertwined. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
For our listeners, you and I have known each other for 15 years or more, I think.
Yes, I think that's true.
Yeah, and there's an interesting intersection between the kinds of work that I do with clients, that Gina does with her clients and students, and the kind of work that you do. In a sense, you've got to wear two hats, don't you, as you're working with your clients? One is the human side of it, and one is the, well, what makes common sense might not be what makes legal sense, and all of it has to work.
Yeah, it's the role that I play with organizations is often I have to play devil sometimes because want to run their business in certain ways, but if it doesn't work legally, then it's my job to be the messenger. Shot periodically. Hopefully, I don't walk around with a lot of holes, so I try and do it in a way that that works for the business and will be acceptable. And I strive. The biggest challenge that I have every day is to figure out a way to organize around what the business owner wants to do and at the same time be compliant with the laws.
And I think today we're going to ask you for some case studies, because I think we all learn when we hear the examples of that intersection between what a business owner or business leader wants to do in the business and how to get that done.
Right. I mean, sometimes it says that, sometimes it just can't work because it's not legal to do it. But most of the time, we can figure out a compromise where both gets done.
So as a little bit of background for our listeners, how did you come to be doing this kind of work?
Well, for many years, I ran a rehabilitation consulting company, which is kind of a fringe human resources organization. Fringe being that I worked in the workers' comp industry. Every employer who has one employee or more needs to have workers' comp. So, and workers' comp covers the people in the organization. So, I was interacting a lot with employers and human resource executives in their insurance area, in their risk management area. And later on, as my rehabilitation business wound down, mostly because of the legal, the legislative aspects of the business just wasn't going in the right direction for me, and I could see that over the years that the business, the regulations were changing so that our business was going to disappear. And so I started making adjustments to that. And so I went back to school, got my PhD in organizational psychology, and started doing and my training is in organizational psychology, so it's like the people side of business. We learn the financial side, but we really evaluate the business from the people side. And so it was a natural to really specialize in human resources, and so here I am.
And what's the scope, the whole range of kinds of services that you bring to an organization, to a business owner, to a leadership team?
Well, I have kind of a unique perspective because of my background in disability and working with organizations on the risk side and also the organizational development side of my training. So I tend to be able to work a lot of different aspects of the business, but in general, the organizational development side of the business, I do a lot of work with leadership teams and team building and organizational restructuring of businesses. Not so much from the financial point of view, because that's usually done within the financial structure of the business, and then it's integrated into a leadership team. But I really work with leadership teams more from the human side, from the management, interactive relationship side of the business, and structure and help restructure it that way. And then, of course, once you start working with people, it's just a natural to move right into human resource issues, compliance issues, all the regulations that the government puts on organizations in order to just function.
So I would love it if you would give some examples of the range of types of organizations that you've dealt with. I know over the years you've dealt with everything across the country from major not-for-profit organizations that are going through that kind of restructuring to smaller and more intimate businesses. It would be great if you could give some examples.
Yeah, I work with a lot of nonprofits. I work with a lot of for-profit organizations also. On the for-profit side, most of the businesses I work with are between 300 and 50 employees. They're warehousing operations, they're food distribution companies. I've got clients that are trucking companies, so they actually move the stuff. Warehouse operations, restaurants, smaller restaurants. But I've got one restaurant that has a chain of seven stores. I got another restaurant that has a chain of three stores and a commercial brewery. I'm all over the place. And then on the nonprofit side, I have one very large nonprofit that has, 3,000 employees that I interact mostly with their human resource staff. They have 25 human resource staff, so they obviously don't need me for everything. But a lot of what I did with them was I augment their expertise. So if they have an issue that they don't have an expert internally that can handle that issue, they'll call me, and because of my wide background, I can generally either plug in for them an expert someone who has the expertise that they do need, or I can do it myself. One of the things I don't do, and I want to be really clear about this, is I don't tend to, I would not consider myself an expert on benefits or an expert on pensions, retirement programs, things like that, which are part of the HR structure. It's just a specialty in and of itself, and I just have never really gravitated towards expertise in those areas. So those are the kinds of things that I would always refer out to an expert in those areas. And in, in the state of California, that's a big issue.
Oh, that's true. Here we are sitting in California. We've got our double books, our double set of challenges to deal with
that's
here.
That's right. And in most, and actually most of the larger states are very, very labor and employment oriented in terms of legal. You know, if you're in Illinois, you know, New York, Massachusetts, Florida, you know, you are going to have major labor and employment requirements if you're a business owner.
And when we say requirements, what do some of those look like?
Well, I mean, just to give you an example, some of the things that I deal with in California, I mean, not so much in other states because California is extremely litigious and is the most heavily regulated for businesses, not necessarily for the I can be bold enough to say not ever really on the business person's side. You know, so I mean, like right now in the state of California, wage and hour, we have very strange overtime rules. We have very, very difficult meal and rest break rules that expose the employers to major, major liabilities and legal action.
What's
right now? Well, I'll give you an example, and this has been a very difficult. This is one of those examples of the employer wants to do it differently, but the law just doesn't allow it. Let me go back. I think we have enough time. Let me go back.
We have a full hour, so we get to use it all.
Okay. Let's go back to what happened here in the state of California back in the early 2000s. There was some controversy over whether the employer was required to provide a meal period for employees. Everybody always had a lunch break. But then some issues started coming up about, well, I didn't get my lunch break, and I was supposed to get my lunch break, and the laws, the compliance and the rules around this were a little bit, kind of open. There wasn't a lot of regulation around it. And then all of a sudden, the state of California got involved, and that's never a good thing. and so they said, they came out in mid-2000s, they came out with an edict that basically said, employers, you're required to give a minimum of a 30-minute lunch break, and if you don't give it, it's on you. You have to make sure that your employees take that lunch break. And you know, we all know that as employers, you know, some people like to stay at their desk when they eat. Some people want to leave a little bit earlier. Some people, you know, they want to work through their lunch break so they can leave a little bit earlier. And a lot of employers were really not manufacturing, not employers that were on manifacturing or assembly lines, because then, you know, the bells ring and people do what they're supposed to do when the bells ring. But in other kinds of organizations, you know, people were pretty loose about it, and employers were pretty loose about it. You know, I don't know any employer that said, no, you can't take a lunch break. But there are businesses that would say, you know, we're kind of busy right now. Can you work through your lunch break today? You know, and, you know, maybe I'll try and let you off early, or, you know, I'll give you a double break tomorrow or something like that. Or, you know, you've got people in the field that are working it out in the field, and they're in the middle of something, and they don't want to interrupt and take a lunch break because the client is waiting for them to fix, you know, the computer or fix the system, you know, and they're testing the system, and it takes a number of hours, and they have to sit in front of the computer, and they can't really take a lunch break. These kind of things were going on, and the employers are pretty flexible about it, and so were the employees. And then all of a sudden, the state of California said, "Well, you're in trouble if you don't give the lunch break. As a matter of fact, it's going to cost you money, and we're going to send you into a wage and hour issue, because if they don't get their lunch break, then it pushes them into an overtime situation. Now you owe them overtime." And so all of a sudden, the wage and hour lawsuit started coming up because people were saying, "I wasn't taking my lunch break. I'm due this overtime," and it was really just causing a lot of problems. And then So the case went to the Supreme Court, and we waited about 8 years for the Supreme Court. Now, maybe not 8 years. I think it might have been 6 to 8. It was a long time. We waited for the Supreme Court to the Supreme Court in California to make a decision about what employers had to do and what they didn't have to do. And it was, you know, it was very arduous for them because all of a sudden the employers were spending all their time worrying about whether their employees were taking a lunch break or requiring them to take a lunch break, that kind of stuff. So finally, in 2012, the Supreme Court made a decision. And they clarified, it wasn't really clear, but I think we all in the business are pretty clear about what the Supreme Court's telling us what to do. And so they loosened it up a little bit. You know, you don't have to lord over an employee and make them take a lunch break, but you have to offer a lunch break. You have to document whether the person took the lunch break or didn't take the lunch break. There are penalties if you require a person to work through a lunch break, which happens sometimes. You know, if you're in a special situation, you ask employees not to take their lunch break. It will cost you the time of the lunch plus an hour of premium time. You know, so you're going to pay for it, but you're not necessarily going to get sued for it. So all of a sudden, the timekeeping became a huge issue, and I'm still dealing with employer. I mean, this law changed. I mean, the Supreme Court made this decision in February of 2012, and as late as last month, I had one of the provisions of the Supreme Court decision was you cannot tack rest periods and meal periods onto the end of your shift so that you can leave early. You know, so
even if an employee wants to do that, they cannot.
That's right. And that was the issue. A lot of employers and employees kind of put their heads together and said, you know, let's do it this way. We'll give you the time, but let's do it this way. And I'll give you an example. I just was working with a client last month. And I worked with them earlier. I actually wrote their employee handbook. And when it was kind of loose, and I knew that they did this. What they do is they combine their afternoon lunch break. I'm sorry, their afternoon rest break, which is a 15-minute rest break. And they combine it with their half-hour lunch so that they give the employees a 45-minute break, and they work through their afternoon rest break, right? So the employees want to do it. They want a little bit longer lunch break. If they want to go out to lunch or something like that, the location of this plant was an engineering company, so it's like an industrial plant. You know, their location was a little bit further away. If people wanted to go to lunch at a restaurant, it would take a little bit longer. They would be late, and so then. They gave them 45 minutes, and they said, okay, we're just going to do this. We're going to be loose about it, and we're cool. Everybody was cool. For years, they were doing it. So they came to me last month, and I said, you cannot do this anymore. They said, well, everybody wants to do it. I said, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what the corporate culture is. Doesn't matter what the agreement is.
That's right.
All the people in the organization.
All the people in the organization that are non-exempt employees, okay, all the hourly employees, were required to do this, and they weren't happy about it. They were actually pretty upset about it. It's a non-union shop, but it was, you know, they were very upset about it because they were very used to this thing, this arrangement, and they liked it. They kind of all agreed on it, and when it originally happened, they went to the employer and they said, "Can we do this?" And management said, "Yeah, we're cool with it." You know, they were going to have to give the time anyway. So if you want to combine it, it's okay with us. You know, and they said, you know, we've been doing this for a long, long time. The owner was talking to me. Said, you know, we've been doing this a long time, and I saw how you changed our meal and rest break policies. And I said, I said, look, and this is what Linda, you're a consultant also, so you know how we do this. You know, I said, look, my job is to tell you what the rules are. I can't require you to do this, but. What I'm going to tell you is this particular issue has been worked on, it's been chewed on, it's gone through every court system in the state. This is not something you want to play with because it's such easy exposure to you. I mean, you are kind of waving a red flag and saying, look what I'm doing. You know, I thought this is not one of those battles as a business owner that I would suggest that you fight because it's a loser. It's a loser, and it's major penalties. When we're talking about thousands of dollars if you start looking at number of people doing it. You know, I mean, it's penalties on every pay period, you know, and it just gets really punitive. And I said, I said, you guys are going to do what you want to do, but I'm not writing a policy that isn't compliant. And if you have the policy that I wrote, you are going to be non-compliant with your policy on top of non-compliant with the law. So I just don't think this is one of those things. This is one of those fights I had with the client that you know is unfortunate sometimes because I don't think the original policy was such a bad policy.
Right, and unfortunately, this particular business owner wasn't in front of the Supreme Court arguing for some sense.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, finally we had a number of conversations about it, and finally she said, okay, I'm going to do what you suggest. But, you know, as a consultant, that's all I can do is say this is what I suggest. You know, if it wasn't this particular issue, I might have said, you know, you can play with it a little bit over here, you can play with it a little bit over here and still be compliant. You know, we could edge it a little bit, you know, on other kinds of rules and laws. But there are certain things in the law that are just so specific and so, you know, have such high levels of liability in terms of a lawsuit that you just don't want to play with it. And wage and hour is really big in California. Wage and hour lawsuits are really big in California, and they have huge liability. The other thing in California, this is not a new change, but, you know, the state of California has a 8-hour, 40-hour overtime. So you get overtime if you work 9 hours in a day. If you work 8 hours and 15 minutes in one day, you get 15 minutes of overtime, even though you still only work 40 hours. Everywhere else in the country, if you work, you know, it's overtime if you work more than 40 hours a week. So in California, we have a dual system. So if you've got a busy, you know, if you've got a busy day and you tell your warehouse people, oh, I need to get that last truck loaded before you leave, so just stay on the job, you know, and everybody stays 20 minutes longer, you owe every single one of those employees 20 minutes of overtime at time and a half, you know, and it doesn't matter whether they work 7 hours the rest of the week or they end up working, even if they work 30 hours for the week, they would still get overtime on that one day. So, I mean, that's another issue that it has been very difficult for employers to not only accept, but to keep track of, because it requires a lot of paperwork.
And one of the toughest underlying issues here is the relationship side of it, because, of course, the employers want their employees happy and loving working there and working as a team and collaborating with management, and it's outside of both hands. Neither
right.
one gets
you know,
the control. In these particular kinds of issues.
That's right. I have a couple clients that are Jewish synagogues, and I have a couple of these are nonprofits, and I have a couple of clients that are churches. And we all know if any of us go to synagogues or, you know, places of worship, you know, for Christians the day of worship is Sunday, and you know, you don't work on Sunday, and you go to church on Sunday, and you know Sunday's the Sabbath. But someone's got to work at the church on Sabbath, right? And the same thing with synagogues. You know, someone's got to keep the synagogue running while everybody else is resting, right? And so what these organizations tend to do is they have non-practicing or different religious individuals who work on the Saturday for Jewish synagogues or work on the Sunday for churches. And so they're working off hours. You know, everybody else is off, but they're working. And these organizations, before the overtime change happened, these organizations would just give comp time, you know, and the employees loved it. I mean, it was a really family environment. These kind of organizations tend to be very sensitive and very family-oriented. Everybody knows each other. There's usually not a lot of turnover in these kinds of organizations. So people have worked together for a lot of years. It's kind of a family environment. And so they would say, well, you know, I'm going to work on Saturday, so, you know, I'm going to go out to my son's soccer game you know, on Wednesday afternoon, I'm going to watch the game over the high school or whatever, and they would have the comp time, and so they wouldn't get docked, and they liked it that way. All of a sudden, the overtime rules changed, and we had to say, no, you can't get comp time. You're going to get money. Well, I don't want the money. I want the time. Well, you know, we would like to give you the time, but we can't do that. You know, so, you know, sometimes, certainly in the state of California and probably many of the other larger states, you know, the legislature makes decisions that affect not only the business owners, but they affect employees in a way that they don't want to be affected, and there's no input. You just don't, there's nothing you can do about it. You know, so some of these things you just have to do.
I think Gina's trying to come off mute. She's gonna join us. She's got a barking dog behind her, so we'll let her enjoy the barking dog for a minute. You know, Bob, one of the questions that comes to my mind that I think is helpful for listeners, you made an observation a little while ago that, you know, some of these issues relate to any business that has even one employee. So you've been talking about this notion of handbook, and this is a national issue. This is not just a California issue about what businesses are, quote, supposed to have in place as guidelines for that relationship between an employer and an employee, aren't they?
Right, right. Yes, and, you know, handbooks are an interesting topic. I have my own opinions about handbooks, but, you know, when I had a larger organization, we didn't have a handbook. And that was probably not in my best interest or in the employee's best interest. And you know, in clients, smaller clients, especially entrepreneurial clients come to me and say, do I need to have a handbook? And I will usually say, well, you know, it's pretty recommended. But they would, you know, they'll say, I don't want a handbook because I don't want to get tied into a policy that I don't want to do, you know. And I'll say things like, well, you know, that's exactly why you do need a handbook, because here's the problem for this is the trap for the employer. I'll tell you what the trap for the employee is also, but here's the trap for the employer. You don't have a vacation policy, right? So you know, Joe Smith, your trusted manager, or your trusted hourly employee who has been very consistent, has worked for you for a long time, you like him, does good work, comes to you and says, you know, I got a wedding in Montreal and I'm gonna need, like, you know, a week and a half to go to this wedding because we have to fly out to Montreal. And you say, well, that's great, no problem. And you haven't taken a vacation in a long time, so, you know, have a great time. And so he agrees to pay him for the whole time. You know, he doesn't have a policy on vacation time, so he just agrees to let the guy off and go have a good time, right? Then, you know, then Sam comes up, who has been working for him for 6 months and who he doesn't particularly care for, doesn't feel like he's a good employee, and says, you know, my family's taking a vacation over on Lake Mead. We're going to take a houseboat out on Lake Mead, and we're going to be gone for a week. I'd like the time off. And he said, no, I can't let you do that. And I'm certainly not going to, you know, I'll let you take 3 days, but I won't let you take the whole time, and I'm not going to pay you for it. And, you know, so all of a sudden now you have two different policies for your employees, and that's what gets you in trouble. So, you know, so if I'm Sam, I'm saying, you like the other guy better because you treat him better, so you're discriminating against me because I'm black or I'm white or I'm Mexican or I'm Asian, or, you know, because I'm over 40 or because, you know, I have a limp, or, you know, whatever reason, they're going to say you're discriminating against me. So now the business owner is in a lawsuit or a potential lawsuit because they didn't have a clear policy. And so that's kind of the stories, and this happens all the time. So that's especially with smaller employers. And so that's kind of the reason, that's a story I tell employers when they say to me, you know, I don't really feel like I want to have an employee handbook. That's exactly why you have an employee handbook. So you sit down, you make decisions about the general policies you're going to have. You can always change policies. But there's two things I recommend. One is you sit down and you think about the policies you're going to have and the way that you're going to treat your employees. And you write it down so the employees know what to expect and you know what you're going to give. And then on the other side, the other thing that I say is you never put a policy in place that you don't intend to follow. Because not following a policy, it's kind of like what I said. You know, I wrote this policy for the meal and break periods. If this employer didn't follow that policy, that's like evidence against them in a lawsuit. So you don't want to ever have a policy in your handbook that you don't intend to follow. Now there are a lot of policies in the handbooks that you don't follow because you forget about them or you're unclear and that kind of stuff. That's a no-no also. But you know, that's an honest mistake. But you know, one of the things that I see all the time is, you know, employers kind of automatically put a performance evaluation policy into their handbook. You know, we're gonna evaluate your performance, every 6 months or on a yearly. You know, when you first start, we're gonna evaluate your performance after 90 days, which is your introductory period, and then we're gonna revisit it at your anniversary day, and we're gonna give you raises and all the stuff's in there. And then all of a sudden the business owner or the manager gets busy and, you know, 90 days goes by and no one does anything and 6 months goes by and no one does anything and the anniversary comes up and no one does anything and there hasn't been any evaluation. And then all of a sudden there's performance problems and you let the person go and they say, well, I never got an evaluation and I never got, you know, no one ever told me. And this and what I'm saying happens all the time. And so I say to them, when I sit down with an employer and say, you know, you want an employee handbook? Okay, here's a section. Do you do performance evaluations? Well, I do them, but I don't do them consistently. I kind of do them on an as-needed basis. I said, okay, we're not going to have a policy on performance evaluations then, because if you put a policy in that says you're going to do performance evaluations at these intervals and you're kind of loose about it, then don't have it. You know, do them when you want to do them, don't have a policy about them, and move on. Because otherwise, it's just going to vacuum and you're going to paint yourself into a corner with a policy, and that's
right.
Not what
and,
I want.
And for employees, it may be very frustrating to not be getting feedback, but
that's right.
Then it's purely a relational issue and not running into the legalities.
That's right. And you know, speaking of performance evaluations, the trend in businesses, especially because the younger generations in businesses and in organizations now expect that they're going to get a lot more feedback, need a lot more feedback than every 6 months or every year. And so actually a lot of the businesses I work with now, I'm not recommending that they do formal performance evaluation programs on a scheduled basis, because I just don't think it works for the younger generation. And I don't really believe that it's good performance management. I think good performance management takes place on a daily basis, a weekly basis, a monthly basis. What I recommend to my clients is you are constantly evaluating the job someone is doing, adjusting and reevaluating. It's that cycle. You know, part of my orientation is, you know, when you study organizational development and you do organizational development consulting, and Linda, I know you do a lot of this kind of stuff, you kind of start seeing things as cycles, seeing things as systems. And systems tend to repeat themselves. And so I always recommend kind of a system of performance evaluation, whereas you are observing, evaluating, correcting, observing, evaluating, correcting on a constant basis. That's what the younger generation needs. They don't need a piece of paper that says you did this good, you did that good. What they need is considerable feedback on an ongoing basis to evaluate, to observe, evaluate, and correct them. Now, but then you run into this problem of what do I do about documenting that stuff? Well, what I always recommend in terms of documenting it is you're writing emails, you're writing texts, you're when you have a conversation, you encapsulate that conversation in a note to the individual. This is to confirm our conversation this afternoon. This kind of stuff. And so you're documenting your performance evaluation in less structured ways, but it's on an ongoing basis. So you're constantly talking to your employees and confirming conversations so that you have a string of expectation comments to the employee that's documented. And so if the person is not performing down the road, you have this constant kind of dialogue relationship with the individual. Now, it doesn't work so well for people for managers or supervisors that don't have people skills. It's torture for them. For a lot of baby boomers in industry, it's torture for them to say, you mean I have to talk to my employees? But for those who have the skill, that's what I recommend. And for those who have the interest in doing it, that's what I recommend. I think it's a much more effective performance management.
A lot of our listeners, Bob, this is Gina. A lot of our listeners are solopreneurs. They're, mainly them, but they do have some semblance of a team, albeit not always are they employees. A lot of times they're independent contractors.
Uh-huh.
What we're talking about today, how does it apply to them?
Well, okay, so let's just move into the issue of communication then. Because even though an independent contractor, if they're really an independent contractor, you're hiring them for their expertise. You're hiring them because they have a subject matter expertise that you don't have or that you need to plug into a project or a job. So you're not going to tell them how to do the job. So what then becomes extremely important for you to be running a successful collaboration, because now what we're talking about is really a collaboration, is to be extremely clear about what it is that you are doing in the project, what your goals are, and to learn how this person's or how you, in collaboration with this person, is going to go about it. You're not going to tell them how to do it, but you have to agree on the end point, you have to agree on the start point, and you have to agree about milestones in between. So it is really essential that you have good communication with your collaborators, or it's going to fall apart. And then if the contract is your contract, then it makes you look bad, even though your independent contractor is making the mistake. Because I do consulting in a number of different areas, I collaborate myself. I work in those kinds of relationships with other consultants on a really regular, a fairly regular basis. And I do a lot of work in the nonprofit healthcare arena. And I collaborate with another consulting group that really has a lot of operational, medical, clinical experience, and they have a clinical team. So they go into these clinics and they really work with the clinical team. That's not what I do. They tend to hire me into their collaboration for organizational restructuring, human resource issues, because that's my specialty. And one of the things that's really great about working with this consulting group is everybody has a job, everybody's good at their job, and we sit down and we, before we enter into a consulting contract, all the collaborators know exactly, you know, we discuss it, and we have input into the proposal. We each have input into our section of the proposal. So it starts out as a collaboration. We get the contract, and then we sit down with each other. We say, okay, you're going to do this, you're going to do this, you're going to do this. This is your area. You need to you need to keep me informed on this because these issues affect me. So we have a huge amount of coordination and communication. It becomes extremely important. As soon as that, I used to work with, it's funny because I just got an email from them today. We used to have a nurse practitioner on our team that didn't play well with us. And she used to not communicate. And so she would go off and do things while we were she was really good at what she did, but she would do it independently. And so we would come in to a situation with the clinic, and we would see what she had done, but we didn't know she was going to do that. She just kind of did it on her own, and it affected what we were going to do, and so we got blindsided a lot. And so it makes you feel, when your team isn't communicating and you go into the organization, you kind of have egg on your face with the organization because the organization expects that you're going to be communicating. And so we ended up, it turned out that now the person is no longer working in the consulting group. She took a full-time job. But you know, it wasn't working because she wasn't communicating. And so when you work in these collaborative environments, you have to agree to have a very high level of communication. I do things with the owner of the other consulting group. If it's her client that, you know, I just finished a project with the leadership team with her client. She had nothing to do with this. I mean, I did this on my own, but I contracted through her company. I told her constantly what I was doing. The proposal was put through her. She had a right to change the proposal in any way as long as I could do it. And I carried out the entire project. No one else from the consulting team was involved except me. I did it through her company, but I made sure that she was that I was communicating with her constantly throughout. Because the other thing that happened here is, from that consultation, there were three additional projects that came out of that I had nothing to do with, that weren't in my area of expertise. And so that's kind of how I'm looking at it. In order for us to perpetuate these collaborative contracts, when you're in an organization, you're looking for other opportunities for other members of the consulting team, the collaborative team. So I think that's kind of how it works a lot for me. I kind of look out for these kinds of things when I'm working with sole practitioners who have different expertise, and we can collaborate together. Gina, did I hit what you were talking about?
You sure did, Bob. That really helps a lot for our listeners, I think.
Communication is so important.
It really is. As a sole practitioner or solopreneur, are there certain types of things you really need to consider communicating around, or is that vary from one business to the next?
I'm not sure I understand. What do you mean by communicating around?
Well, if I think about, you know, a traditional brick-and-mortar business that isn't a solopreneur and having a team and employees, there are certain topics that you definitely are going to see in things like an employee handbook, right? Things
yes.
like their breaks and that sort of thing. Well,
yes.
when you're really dealing with independent contractors and you're not controlling those types of things, what do you need to make sure you're communicating around other than a specific project or a specific task?
Well, I'll give you an example, and I think this hits it. I had you know, with this collaborative agreement I have with this other consulting group on healthcare, we did a major project. We were in the organization for the better part of a year, and we actually helped to open up a clinic that was a collaboration among the clinic. The clinic is a private nonprofit that provides primary care services to patients, to individuals. Okay, it's a Skid Row environment. So it's, you know, it's indigent patients, and it was a collaboration with county services. So you know, Department of Mental Health, Department of Public Health, Department of Health Services. There were about four or five county departments that were integrated into this entire system. And so when we started talking about policies, okay, so now you're talking about policies, you know, and benefits for employees and hours for employees. Everybody was working, they're all under the same roof. Okay, the other issue was all these departments, all these other clinical practitioners, they're all under one roof. And so, but they were employed by multiple agencies. And so my responsibility was to try and standardize as much as possible, to try and standardize benefits, vacation, holidays, you know, sick leave policies, retirement policies, you know, how are you going to time keep and who do you time keep with? One of the issues was we had a on-site clinic manager who was employed by the private nonprofit primary care people, but you had employees who were being supervised from outside agencies that were working in the organization. So they were getting, you know, they had two bosses, right? So my job was to coordinate all that and to try and standardize as much as possible. And it was a very difficult task. Fortunately, those private nonprofit clinics tend to mirror the benefits of the larger county organizations because they're constantly, even when they're not under the same roof, they're constantly sending referrals back and forth, and so they tend to mirror the same hours and stuff. But when you have a Skid Row clinic, your hours are going to be very different than county hours, that kind of stuff. So we really had to blend that, and it took, we had hours and hours of meetings where the heads of the various departments were sitting in a room, and we were comparing policies, and we were trying to decide, you know, what's fair to the employees, what can we do, how can we change these, and you know, we eventually, I mean, it took months and months and months, but we eventually came to a place where we standardized how the employees were going to be treated and how we were going to put policies together. If for instance, I don't work for the clinic, I work for the county, and I'm out sick. Who do I notify? Well, you got to notify two people. You got to notify the site, and you got to notify your employer, you know, who's not on site. You know, the employee needs to know what to do. So you have to put policies together for those kinds of things that are fair and equitable. And so that's the kind of stuff that you have to do sometimes in terms of, you know, one organization is going to have to give up a little bit more. Another organization is going to have to give in over on this side for the employees to standardize. Am I hitting on what you're asking?
You are.
Okay. So, I mean, it goes back to Linda's comment. It's about relationships. You know, in order for me to do that stuff, you have to have a relationship with me. You have to trust that I am being sincere in what I'm attempting to do. You have to trust that I am sincere in terms of my sensitivities to the issues. you know, or you're not gonna, or you're not gonna let me, you know, you're not gonna let me push you in certain directions, you know. You're not gonna show up to the meeting if you don't think I'm interested in really doing something worthwhile. You know, these kind of things are issues, and so it's really about the relationship you build with the people you're working with.
And Linda, before we run out of time, I want to make sure that our listeners know where they can find Bob.
Bob, where would you like to go to find out more information?
Well, my website is www.hrfocususa.com. You can always reach me through my website. My email address is rsnyderman@hrfocususa.com. But if you go onto my website and you just go for information, you know, there's an opportunity for information at HR Focus that comes to me. And my telephone number, there's an 800 number, but also my cell phone number is 818-618-6044.
Wonderful. Bob, you know, I was thinking about the fact that you said that you don't cover comp and benefits issues, but the irony is there is this mix of issues here. So I have a small law firm that I'm consulting to, and in asking about what's working well and what's not, I had a number of those folks say to me, we should have a pay raise and we should have more vacation. Well, you know, there's a feeling of what they believe they ought to be having, but
yeah.
In a lot of places, it's all about rules of thumb. So I was talking with a comp and benefits consultant, and she said, you know, if you've been working someplace for 10 years, you ought to have 2 weeks vacation by the 10-year mark. Well, I'm talking to a 14-year employee who's got 2 years vacation. I'm talking to a 10-year employee, separate conversations, and she's got 1 week vacation. So I don't know that. I'm not a comp and benefits consultant, but I was like,
right.
I can see that I now need to put that comp and benefits consultant together with my client so that she can be educated into what ought to be, what's the market standard,
yes.
And so on.
Yes, yes. Let me clarify. I think you misunderstood me. I do comp. I do comp and benefits. What I don't do is I don't arrange for, when I say benefits, I really mean like health insurance. You know, I'm not the person that's going to write your health insurance for you, or suggest what health insurance or suggest what kind of retirement program. But yes, compensation is something I deal with all the time because your example is exactly what happens. You know, this organization has 2 weeks of vacation, this organization has 1 week of vacation. I work with a lot of organizations don't give vacation. Don't give vacation at all. And I have conversations with the business owners, you know, okay, so why don't you offer vacation? Well, I can't afford it. Well, you know, we might have that same conversation 3 years from now or 2 years from now, them saying I'm losing my employees to my competitors because my competitors are giving them vacation. And I say, well, you know, that's right. I mean, benefits can be a competitive advantage. And so, you know, a business owner, my job and your job, Linda, is not only to connect them with experts in the area, but it's also to help them evaluate. You know, paid vacation or paid sick leave, you know, is that going to give me the competitive edge that I need? That's going to affect my retention in a positive way, so I'm not losing money, but because I'm hiring all the time and spending my training hours and spending my time and money and training people to leave and go to my competitor. So, I mean, that's one of the things that we have to do is we have to help employers, help business owners evaluate the upside and the downside of those kinds of things. I'll tell you, I used to do a lot of work in major retail department stores, okay? And I worked for an organization that was kind of, it wasn't Nordstrom's, but it was kind of had the Nordstrom's mentality, where they wanted to retain their salespeople, right? So they would bring people in, they would treat them really well, they would pay them pretty well, they'd give them benefits, and they didn't want to move it on, right? They wanted to keep them and develop them. And one of their competitors was had 70% turnover in their sales associate area. And I was working with them, and I said, well, isn't that killing you, the sales associate area? Isn't that killing you to have that much turnover? And they said, you know, our business model is that this is the lowest paying, this is the lowest paying job in the organization. We don't put a lot of resources into this job. If you're going to make it through this job, from that point forward, you know, promoting out of sales associate forward, we're going to implement retention strategy. But at the bottom end, they didn't have any retention strategy. They didn't care whether they had 70% turnover. It was easy for them to hire. That was their point of view. I did not agree necessarily with their analysis, but that's what it was. You know, so you have different philosophies, and I think you have to sit down with employers and say, you know, what is your philosophy in terms of how do you want to interact with your employees? What message are you trying to send to your employees? You know, I've got small employers that say, you know, I don't want to give a whole week of sick leave, but I don't feel it's fair not to give any. You know, so they'll say to me, what do you recommend? And I'll say, well, you know, this is the range that I see in my clients. And, you know, sometimes they'll come up with 2 or 3 days of sick leave rather than nothing, you know. So I think our job is really to help business owners evaluate the situation so they can come up with a reasonable decision, and then you can write a policy around it, or you can put you know, walls around it, so that, you know, boundaries around it, so that it makes sense to the employee and the employer, and the employer is not spending too much money. I just finished with a client of mine who needed a competitive edge, and his industry is starting to get more educational certifications are being required in his industry, and he's losing people to other agencies that are larger than his. And we are now talking about, well, if he provides an educational benefit that allows him to encourage his employees to reach the certification level that has to be reached over a period of years, you know, to stay in business, if he paid for that education and used it as a retention tool, would it be worth his time and effort and money to do that for the retention? And he's now, we've talked about it for a couple of sessions now that I'm doing coaching with him, and we've talked about it, and I think he's coming to the conclusion that we've done the research and he knows what it's going to cost him. And we're going to ask the employees who are on the program to commit to a certain number of years after certification, so he knows that he's got the retention. And there's a payback piece if they leave before the commitment is completed. You know, so, and the payback piece is prorated. So, you know, these are the things that I deal with some of my employers in terms of retention and, you know, they're compensation related, but they're not strictly compensation. Anyway, sorry about that. That was kind of long-winded.
No, but it's a really interesting point, because I think people assume that if you have a, quote, job, that you get vacation. I was just thinking about that as you were saying it. It's like we have these assumptions about what you must get by law, and it's not necessarily law. It's convention. And then here in California, we have a whole bunch of things that you would think that should be up to the relationship between the people in the organization, and we've got law overriding it. So it's a fascinating...
That's right. And in jobs, in many of the industries that we work in, it is standard operating procedure to get vacations. However, if you walk into a manufacturing environment, you walk into a warehousing environment, a distribution environment, a trucking environment, many of those organizations do not have sick leave and vacation policy. Or if they do, they have minimal, because they're running, I mean, restaurants have some vacation policies for managers and that kind of stuff, but not usually for the servers and busboys and kitchen staff, because the margins are too, I mean, they don't have the money to do it. And they don't have the personnel to cover people's jobs while they're gone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so there is, you know, there's all these aspects have to be played in and have to be considered in terms of when you're making these policy decisions.
And all of this in the hopes that both the business owner and the employees love what they're doing, so they get out of bed happy and eager to go use all their time,
right.
their intelligence, right. their personal
That's
resources to serve clients, to serve customers, and create a great life for themselves.
That's right. And, you know, fortunately, I have to say that I work with a lot of, you know, I like working with the people that I work with, and I think I'm very fortunate that I work with business owners that they may not be able to give the store, you know, but they treat their employees respectfully. I think their employees know that they're of value to the business owner, and I think that's really important. And I think that, you know, sometimes we do jobs that are not sexy and they're not a lot of fun, but you know, as business owners, we need to make it as fun as possible. We need to make it as nice as possible. We need to make people feel good to come to work so that they will wake up in the morning and show up, like you said. You know, I think that's really important for people. That's a basic relationship issue. If you can't solve that problem, you will never be successful in business because people will not want to show up.
Bob, thank
Absolutely.
You so much for the insights that you shared today. I so appreciate your coming and spending the hour with us.
Well, you're welcome. This has been a lot of fun. I kind of feel like I did most of the talking, but
it should be.
But I guess that's the way it should be. But I hope that people get some good stuff from it, and I'd love to hear from people if they have questions.
And again, you can find Bob at HRFocusUSA.com. Have a great week, everyone. Thank you so much, Bob. This was fantastic. Thanks, Linda.
Thank you.
See you all next week.
Bye-bye.
Join us Tuesday at noon Eastern for the next episode of Breakthrough Directions, from relationship marketing to business success.